different type of aphasia.
Byron, how are you?
I'm happy. Are you pretty? You look good.
What are you doing today?
We stayed with the water over here at the moment and talked with the people for them over there. They're diving for them at the moment. But they'll save in the moment. He'll have water very soon for him. With luck for him.
So we're on a cruise and we're about to
get to Juneau. We will sort right here and they'll save their hands right there for them.
And what were we just doing with the iPad?
Right at the moment, they don't show a darn thing.
The iPad that we were doing.
I'd like my change for me and change hands for me with happy. I would talk with Donna sometimes. We're out with them. Other people are working with them. I'm very happy with them.
Good.
This girl was very good and happy. And I play golf and hit other trees. We play out with the hands. We save a lot of hands on hold for people's, for us, other hands. I don't know what you get, but I talk with a lot of hand for him. Sometime. Am I talk of any more to say?
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it, and I hope the world lasts for you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. Bye-bye.
Have a good day.
Okay, so that's one type of aphasia, very common type, and we're going to see another really different but other common type of aphasia, both of which by the end of the lecture you'll be able to classify with no problem.
Byron, how are you?
So this is another type.
You're 19.
Yeah.
And what happened to you?
Stroke. School and English class.
Okay.
And I book and I read it aloud. But I can't because stroke.
And what happened after the stroke with your speech?
Well, I can't.
What do you do now? Every day?
Speech, then the speech
therapy.
Yeah.
Okay.
And also riding.
Riding what?
Horses.
Yeah, good. And how do you feel?
I'm fine.
You're fine. That's good.
Okay, so those are very different language presentations, both of which involve damage to specific parts of the brain. So by the end of this lecture, you'll know not only how to classify different types of aphasias, but also how to locate where the neuroanatomical damage is based off of the symptom presentation that you're seeing. So first, we're just going to start by talking about the structure of language. For those of you who've had linguistics in college or spent much more time, this is going to be just a very brief overview to introduce you to some terms. So we have at the smallest unit of language our phonemes, right? So phonemes are just basic sounds. So speech sounds, like a letter sound, s, g. And then you put those together into syllables or phonemes, and those are the building blocks of words. So eventually we have words. And then we have words put together into phrases and sentences in a certain grammatical structure, and that will differ from language to language. And then we also have what's called semantics, which are the meaning that we ascribe to different words. And we have pragmatics, which are basically the social and cultural rules of language use. So when I talked yesterday about thought disorder in schizophrenia or different types of psychiatric disorders, thought disorder violates some just general pragmatic rules we have about language, that it should be logical, goal-oriented, and communicate valid or relevant information. So pragmatics are the kind of over-social, cultural understanding of how we use language, things like turn-taking rules in conversation. So these words, phonetics, phonemes, morphemes, semantics, will come back throughout the lecture. So just to remember that phonetics are the basic smallest units of sound that are linguistic. So I'm not talking about car horns or animal sounds, but linguistic sounds, sounds that we can recognize very quickly, unconsciously, as language. And then again, building up to grammar, syntax, and finally, at the highest order, pragmatics. So language development we talked about in the developmental lectures, but we'll just recap that 5 to 7 months, children can already make some basic phonetic sounds. They can go ga-ga-ga, ba-ba-ba. And 7 to 8 months, they're getting more well-formed, what we might call phonemes or syllables. And 1 to 2 years, we have our morphemes, our words. And they're even being able to bind a word with its visual accompaniment. Mama is this person, and she has a voice, and she has a certain way that she looks. So they're able to bind language to meaning. So now we're building a semantic network in our brains, what we'll come back to later as calling the lexicon. We're building basically a network of words and meanings. By 2 years, children are speaking in phrases, and the phrases might be somewhat agrammatical, but by 3, they understand, they've internalized some cultural or linguistic, or the language use of grammar specific to that language. So they've internalized grammatical, syntactical rules for that language. By 5 years, they have a vocabulary of up to 14,000 words. So that's a huge lexicon, and each of those words are linked to their semantic meaning, and they have a range of associates. So we're going to talk about where that is in the brain, or how that's represented in the brain. So the capacity to learn language is innate. Chomsky argues we have a language acquisition device that we're born with, but of course it requires some experiential input, so that a child has to be exposed to language to develop that potential. But all humans have the potential for language. It's believed that it probably was an adaptation, a very useful adaptation, because it allows us to communicate, to build things together, which is definitely advantageous for survival. Every human society uses language, but the organization can be dramatically different, from click sounds in the Kung to actually, you know, having instead of words like we have, these types of fonts, having visual images, pictures in different languages. And we know that language is prioritized in the brain because it's so valuable. It's so it gives us such an advantage as humans, that if you have an injury to language areas in your brain early on in life, that language will reorganize to other parts of the brain. So I had a patient once that had an entire left hemispherectomy shortly after birth due to an in utero stroke. And I tested her by the time she was 40, and there were no deficits in her language functions, but she performed abysmally on visual spatial tasks. So essentially what we consider, and we'll talk about, a left hemisphere function took over the real estate of the right hemisphere and crowded out visual spatial functions of the right hemisphere, because language is much more important for us to survive. So it will take over real estate in the brain that might get used for other things in cases like stroke later in life. Well, let's say up until your brain is finished myelinating, we still have the potential for plasticity. And sometimes language regions will move to right hemisphere visual spatial regions, and you'll see deficits contrary to what you would expect, not in language, but in visual spatial skills. So as I've mentioned, we know that the left hemisphere houses language because we've had enough evidence from patients with brain lesions over time. One of the first most compelling cases was studied by Broca. His name was LeBourne, but everyone called him Tan. He had epilepsy, but he developed over the course of his life a much more increasingly profound aphasia. And that progressed actually to at first it was aphasia, and then more right-sided hand-arm weakness, and finally leg weakness. So you know your organization of the motor strip, right? If we're progressing from a language speech impairment to a right-arm impairment to a leg impairment, it's suggesting something progressive from the left, probably inferior frontal region, and premotor inferior, going more dorsally. And that was exactly what they found in Tan's brain on pathology after his death, that he had a Rasmussen's encephalitis that was slowly and gradually progressing across his life. So he was hospitalized for most of his life and studied by Broca in his remaining days. And all he could say at that point was one word, Tan, which is why they named him Tan. And actually, he could also curse when he was upset. There was one curse word, sacre nom de Dieu, which apparently is French for a very bad curse word, if any of you know what that is. But he could say that when he was upset, which is, we'll come back to that in terms of the right hemisphere's participation in some aspects of language, particularly emotional aspects of language. So in general, though, he could say tan and that Broca localized this damage so clearly to his left inferior frontal region. And another important point about tan was that he was able to understand language. So when asked by Broca, can you tell me the progression of your deficits, he could say, he could point with his left hand, because his right hand was impaired, with his left hand he could point to his mouth, then to his arm, and then to his legs. So he had complex understanding of speech, but he couldn't produce speech. So he had what's called an expressive aphasia, and what we've come to know today as a Broca's aphasia, which is a deficit in expressive speech, but not comprehension of speech. So the left hemisphere for 95% of right-handers and for 70% of left-handers houses language comprehension, language expression, our lexicon, which is essentially all of our words that we know and use, and it puts together phonemes, it assembles phonemes into morphemes, into sentences and phrases, and basically helps us organize the phonemes into articulatory speech. That's all happening in the left hemisphere. For 30% of left-handers, there will be a lot of right hemisphere participation, or language might be bilateral. And they might get, from a right hemisphere stroke or damage, an aphasia, which is called a crossed aphasia. So if someone who has language in their right hemisphere, so 30% of left-handers, if they get a stroke in their right hemisphere, they might get what's called a crossed aphasia. So in the left-hander, you cannot be as sure that language is in the left hemisphere. So when we did epilepsy surgery for left-handers, we would always do a WADA test to anesthetize the left hemisphere to see if they could still speak, if right hemisphere could support language functions, because you couldn't be as sure in a left-hander. But for right-handers, 95% of the time, language will be in the left hemisphere. What does the right hemisphere do then in speech? It does play a role. So in terms of the intonation and the prosody. So we talked about prosody is the kind of ups and downs of speech, right? So if I said the same phrase and with different prosodies, it would have a very different meaning. Like if I said, you know, you really know your stuff, that's kind of a compliment. But if I say, you really know your stuff, it's kind of a question. And if I say, yeah, you really know your stuff, that's sarcasm. The right hemisphere helps us tell the difference. The left hemisphere, it all sounds the same, right? So people with right hemisphere strokes might have difficulty intoning meaning from speech. They might get it wrong in terms of this kind of social cues we take for granted. Also, people with right hemisphere strokes might actually have difficulty understanding things like jokes, humor, or sarcasm because they have more difficulty with emotional aspects of speech. So language networks, primarily in the left hemisphere for most of us, are organized in a fairly predictable way across cultures, across people, that this is essentially very robust, this organization, this neuroanatomical organization of language. So here in the posterior superior temporal sulcus, so here we have our superior temporal sulcus, in the back of it, and extending into the middle temporal gyrus and the inferior parietal region is what we call Wernicke's area. Wernicke's area is the hub for language comprehension. So right now, you are listening to me talk, and your Wernicke's area is processing everything I'm saying. Okay, so this is the hub for language comprehension. Broca's area is the hub for language expression. So we just saw damage to Broca's area with tan. He couldn't express language, but he could understand. So Broca's area involves and usually extends into premotor speech articulatory regions, and people who have damage to Broca's area will have difficulty with speech expression. We also have this important white matter tract connecting Wernicke's area to Broca's area called the arcuate fasciculus. That's not to be confused with the uncinate fasciculus that we talked about in terms of prefrontal lobe control of emotion, very different white matter tract. This is the arcuate fasciculus. So it winds around the Sylvian fissure. So here we have the Sylvian fissure. and the arcuate fasciculus winds underneath and around and connects Wernicke's to Broca's. So we have a lot of action going on in the articular fasciculus. Arcuate fasciculus is helping us hold in mind speech representations as we're listening and as we're organizing our thoughts for speech. So there's a lot of bidirectional connectivity going on here as we're transferring speech words and understanding and meaning to speech articulation. And the Sylvian fissure is one of the, so when you hear the term perisylvian, that means all these important speech areas around the Sylvian fissure. So a lot of times in aphasia chapters and books and stuff, you'll hear perisylvian language regions. That just means all these regions right around, including the arcuate fasciculus, Wernicke's area and Broca's area. So just to recap, Wernicke's language comprehension, Broca's language expression, motor articulation for speech vocalization would happen here next to Broca's in face, mouth, lips region, right? So it's partly motor, but when you have damage to speech articulatory regions, that's different than just damage to the motor. So some people might not be able to speak, but they might be able to make a whistle sound, right? Or do some articulation of their lips, but they've lost their organization of speech. So that's a little more premotor, prefrontal, right? So closer that you get to Broca's area, the more you have motor articulatory commands for that are specific for speech. But that's to be differentiated from just motor commands in the lips. So repetition is supported by the arcuate fasciculus. What do I mean by repetition? If I say, repeat after me, no ifs, ands, or buts, and you repeat it after me, that would be testing your repetition, and you need your arcuate fasciculus for that. So a lot of times when people have damage to arcuate fasciculus, they can't repeat. So just to think about then, going back to your visual and your auditory pathways, when you have language coming in, like it is right now, or let's say you get a phone call, speech comes in through, does anyone remember in the superior temporal gyrus what it's called? Your primary auditory area? Herschel's, great, excellent. Herschel's gyrus is your primary auditory cortex. It goes from Herschel's to Wernicke's area. Well, it does bypass planum temporale up here into Wernicke's area, but what you really need to know is Wernicke's area. So from Herschel's, basically you have any sound goes through auditory cortex, but speech sounds are routed to Wernicke's area, where then they undergo further processing to either think, comprehend, or maybe even plan your own speech in response if you're talking on the phone. So yes, you get a phone call, speech comes in, you're listening, you're comprehending, and you're planning what you're going to say. So there's a lot of activity. And when you actually go to talk, your Broca's area is lighting up. Now when you get a text, that's different input, right? So these are just funny squiggly lines that our brain has learned to recognize as font, as letters. And our brain's learned to organize those letters into words. So that comes through V1 and is routed to this ventral language stream. This is called the visual word form area. It's the left fusiform gyrus. On the right, the fusiform gyrus is for faces. On the left, it's primarily for words. So this W, or this VWFA, stands for visual word form area. So when you get a text, it comes in your visual cortex, goes to visual word form area, and then, makes sense, goes to Wernicke's for further language comprehension. And then sometimes as we're talking to people, you get input from both auditory and visual. You have lip reading. And so that can help speech be more intelligible. So, of course, it's very complex, but just breaking it down and to try to link this with your visual and auditory pathways, now we're just getting a little further downstream. So this is just saying the same thing in text, that for incoming spoken word, it's an auditory signal, and it's routed to Wernicke's area, where we then process the word's meaning. And then we transform it into articulatory codes to speak, right? For reading, it's input from visual cortex, and then we think about the meanings of the words as we're reading, we're comprehending, so you need Wernicke's area for reading as well. And you need, actually we'll focus a little bit more on areas around Wernicke's that are specialized for reading. And then for writing, we need to transfer these thoughts and words and meaning into actually graphomotor commands. So then that's a different type of output for writing, and it would involve more hand motor area for actually writing or doing these. So you have orthographic, so you can see a letter, and you're asked, okay, write this letter. You see a letter, you have to transform those squiggly lines into what you know are letters. So you do an orthographic to phonemic transformation, and then you need to do a phonemic to an articulatory transformation to actually write it out. But you have all you have now the organization for this because you know your motor regions, and now you know your speech regions, how this happens. So the lexicon is basically, the word lexicon means it's essentially our representations for words, their meaning. So representations for words and meaning aren't always just, I mean, it's not the just letters in your brain. You have the meaning. They stand for things. So when we think of the word run, we actually somewhat activate our motor centers because words are linked to their semantic meaning is actually linked to, let's say, for verbs, for action verbs, to motor areas. And so some people argue that in the lexicon, you actually have some organization that allows, so if you have a word that has a visual component, like giraffe, you might activate to some degree your visual regions that help you with the representation for what a giraffe looks like. But your lexicon now, you're developing, it's essentially your semantic knowledge of different words. So every time I give you a word definition like lexicon, you're building your lexicon. You're adding it too. So this is kind of like your lexicon that you've built in this neuroscience module, all the different words that you're learning the meanings to. Now, lexical access is the term that means when you try to retrieve a word from your lexicon. So when you're talking, you're always trying to retrieve the right word from your lexicon to explain what you're trying to say. That's called lexical access. Okay, so I want you to think about this. You have a patient who has a stroke, and he has a funny presentation of symptoms. Can you understand how this could happen? Okay, so you're a neurologist, you're sitting in your office, a patient comes in, is having some difficulties with language after a stroke, and you show him a picture of an object, right? And he can't name it. Let's say you show him a picture of keys. He can't name the keys by seeing them. And then you dangle the keys, right? And he can't tell what it is by the sound. But you let him feel the keys, and he's like, oh, those are keys. So how could this be? So in this case, 73% of you, yes, got it right, that he wasn't his visual path. So essentially, the white matter connecting the visual to middle temporal, the kind of home of the lexicon, let's say, middle temporal region on the left is damaged. Auditory pathways to the middle temporal region are damaged, but somatosensory pathways to the lexicon, middle temporal region, are not damaged. So 73% of you, yes, that would be the answer. So how does that happen? Again, we might have damage to these pathways, but essentially pathways from the somatosensory cortex to the lexicon are intact. So that would be accurate word retrieval for tactile, but not visual or auditory input. So now we're going to move into more fine-grained distinction between the aphasias. In order to differentiate the different kinds of aphasias, you want to go ahead and think about ways you would assess the different components of language that you would need to assess to be able to differentiate these. So the goal when you do an aphasia evaluation is to know what kind of aphasia syndrome so you can localize the damage. Now, of course, this developed prior to MRI. So you're going to be practicing in a day and age where before you've done your extensive aphasia examination, you probably have the results from the MRI on your desk. So it's no longer as critical in terms of lesion localization as it used to be, but it can really help you in terms of planning the types of rehab, setting up their treatment plan, what aspects of language are breaking down so that you can set up the appropriate treatment plan to rehabilitate those aspects of language. So you need to assess comprehension of language, and you have to assess it from spoken language. So how is their, are they able to understand when you're talking to them, and are they able to understand written language? So written language is easy. You can just show them a sentence, you know, close your eyes, and if they do it, then they could read. But spoken language, you have to give them commands. So you can give them simple commands like point to the red shape, or you can give them more complex commands, point to the small red square. So you can give them commands that increase in complexity to test how their language comprehension. They might be able to understand simple commands, but everything breaks down with more complex commands. For naming, as I already mentioned, you'd want to assess their ability to retrieve a word, so lexical access, or what we would call naming deficits. So you want to test those in visual, so just showing them pictures of things and saying, what is this called? Like, what is this called? Holding up your pen or pencil, what is this called? And if they say pen or pencil, they can name it. Auditory naming, you can do things like, the king wears a crown on his head. So they have to fill it in. So they have to understand what you're saying in order to find the word head. Tactile naming, you can give them something to hold with their hand and see if they can name it by feeling it. You also have to assess repetition, and this is really critical. You'll understand why repetition is going to help you differentiate the different syndromes by the end of the lecture. But for repetition, the way you assess it is you can give them simple phrases, like I said before, no ifs, ands, or buts, and they can increase in complexity. The fat brown cow ignored the white bird on his back, right? And they can get longer and longer. So friends of mine, they're neurologists. They just had a few sentences they would just, you know, use on a regular basis when they're doing their exam with patients of increasing complexity to test the patient's repetition. You also need to test expressive speech. So of course you're going to be talking to them and listening in their normal conversational speech for errors or abnormalities in expressive speech. But formally you can do that by giving them, this is a cookie theft picture from the Boston Aphasia Examination. So you give them a picture and you ask them to describe what they see. And you can listen for things like if their speech is fluent. In the first video I showed you with Brian, his speech was fluent. And the second video I showed you, Sarah, her speech was non-fluent. Okay, so his speech was fluent but completely abnormal. Hers was non-fluent, but she knew what to say and she could hear her own errors. So fluent versus non-fluent, you understand from those videos. The rhythm and prosody, you might have also noticed in the first video with Brian, he had normal rhythm and prosody, right? It's just the content was abnormal. But he understood, or he was, basically if you didn't listen to what he was saying, he sounded perfectly normal in his prosody. The content, though, was abnormal in Brian, and the content was riddled with what we call paraphasias. So when you, and I told you this in lecture yesterday, a paraphasia is when you retrieve the wrong word. So again, we come back to this idea of lexical access. So if he wanted to retrieve the word hippopotamus, and instead he got hippopotamus or, you know, pihotonymus, something that was similar but not the same, that would be a phonemic paraphasia because he mixed up the phonemes. If he wanted to get the word president but couldn't get it, he might just say head man, right? Which would be kind of the same idea but not exactly the right word. So that would be a semantic paraphasia. And then you might hear abnormalities in articulation, dysarthria. So that's when essentially their speech, motor, articulatory areas are damaged that they might have difficulty pronouncing the right phonemes. And then you have to test writing as well. So that's easy. You just have them write a sentence. And you'll learn how to do a lot of this on your mental status exam in small groups on Monday and Tuesday. So we're going to start with Wernicke's aphasia. So from in terms of Brian versus Sarah, who do you think had Wernicke's aphasia? Brian, exactly. He had what's called a fluent aphasia. His speech was loquacious. That means it was full. There was a lot of it. They talk a lot. So their speech rhythm is normal, but their speech content is abnormal. They use the wrong words, words that don't exist. Their repetition is also abnormal, so they can't repeat. And that's because they have damage to the some degree of damage to the arcuate fasciculus or regions near to the parasylvian area. So when you can't repeat, there's essentially what that does. It tells you that the damage is in the parasylvian region. When, in this case, his comprehension of written language is still going to be abnormal, but, and this varies from patient to patient, typically it's better than for spoken speech, but again, that can vary a lot. Penmanship is okay, but there's a lot of misspelling and inaccuracies, and naming is like we talked about, really bad. He has lots of paraphasias. Sometimes you can get a hemianopia. Why is that? Because a Wernicke's aphasia is more posterior, and the greater the extent of the damage, the more likely you're going to have extension into visual areas, so you might get visual deficits as well with the Wernicke's aphasia. So it helps to think about posterior and anterior in terms of aphasias, right, as well as parasylvian and non-parasylvian, which we'll come to. Now, Wernicke's aphasia typically involves damage or a stroke to the inferior divisions of the middle cerebral artery. So you talked about the middle cerebral artery in your arteries and meninges lecture. And you may not have gotten into too much, I don't think, the superior and inferior division, but at some point the MCA bifurcates and you have the inferior division that provides or supplies the temporal and parietal cortices, and the superior division supplies the frontal, some of the inferior frontal regions where Broca's region is. So of course if you have damage to the superior division of the MCA, you're going to get more of a Broca's aphasia. So just to repeat that, the middle cerebral artery supplies most of the temporal lobe, right? You remember from your artery and meninges lecture, most of the temporal lobe, but it divides, and so the superior division would, a stroke in the superior division would give rise to more of a Broca's aphasia, and a stroke in the inferior division would give rise to more of a Wernicke's. So Broca's aphasia is characterized as non-fluent, and that's what we saw with Sarah. So she was not able to fluently speak. She had a lot of halting in her speech, and she was, very important, she was aware of her deficit. Was Brian aware of his deficit? Nope, because he couldn't comprehend his own speech, so he couldn't hear his mistakes. But a Broca's aphasia, they can hear, and they understand. They have intact comprehension. So they know when they're making mistakes, which is why it was so hard for her, for Sarah, because she could tell what she was saying wasn't right, and it was bothering her. And so her speech was much more halting, stuttering. They have what's called telegraphic speech content. That word telegraphic is like an old-fashioned word for when people would send telegraphs without ands or ifs or buts. It was just like, you know, need help now was a telegraph without all the filler words. So the Broca's speech is similar to that. It's called, sometimes characterized as telegraphic speech. They're missing syllables. They get, they're agrammatical. So a patient might say, you know, when am I going home from the hospital, they might say, go I home when, you know. So they might get the grammar a little bit wrong. But normal comprehension, writing can be agrammatical as well with some misspelling. And comprehension of written language is not as good as for spoken language. Again, this really varies from patient to patient. But what's important is that the other symptoms you might see with a more anterior aphasia, so a Broca's aphasia, the other symptoms might include hemiplegia, right? So motor. Why? Because it's more anterior. So when you differentiate a Broca's from a Wernicke's, you're thinking posterior and anterior. Posterior is going to have more visual deficits, and anterior is going to have more articulatory or more motor deficits. Conduction aphasia is when patients can't repeat. It's that simple. They are missing they have damage to their arcuate fasciculus, right? So connecting Wernicke's to Broca's. Of course, this is not the extent of the arcuate. It really spans around the parasylvian, but this is just to kind of remind you that it's the area connecting Broca's to Wernicke's. So speech rhythm is normal. Speech content is largely normal, but going to have some paraphasias. But repetition is abnormal. They simply can't repeat. So this area that holds in mind the speech content to be able to form it into the commands you would need to repeat is broken. So that bidirectional connection between Wernicke's and Broca's is impaired. So they can't repeat. and writing and naming. So there's occasional errors, but and you might see some hemiparesis or neglect of right-sided stimuli. That's probably because there's some damage from areas from the parietal region as well, but that's rare. So in general, when you think conduction aphasia, the important thing to remember is it's repetition, impairment in repetition, conduction aphasia. Okay, Gerstmann syndrome is an interesting aphasia syndrome because their speech rhythm is normal, their speech content is normal, repetition is normal, comprehension is normal, but they can't comprehend written language and they can't read. Okay, so writing is abnormal, reading written word is abnormal, naming can be abnormal, and they can often have a hemiparesis or hemianopsia, either one, and that's because it's a little bit outside. So essentially, the Gerstmann syndrome is a very particular type of aphasia. It's, in terms of language, the real deficits are in reading and writing, and it's damage to the association area, the angular gyrus, that is involved in all this converting of fonts and squiggly lines, we call letters, into and so reading would be being able to convert those little lines into words, into semantic meaning, and then being able to write them. So all that conversion happens in the angular gyrus, which is in the inferior parietal region. But this syndrome is really interesting because it also includes left-right confusion. They can't tell their left from their right. Finger agnosia, so if you tell them, lift up your ring finger, they wouldn't know which one. And they have math deficits, so acalculia. So this is a very specific type of syndrome that includes these specific deficits. It's usually included in the aphasias because of the reading deficit. Yes? That is so fascinating. I will have to look it up later and tell you. She asked, would you be able to teach someone with Gerstmann syndrome how to read Braille? I would think because their fingers, they have this finger agnosia, that would be extremely difficult. And there's something about converting. If they knew it before, I don't know the answer, but that's really interesting. I have to look it up. I will say that when you have something like an aphasia, Broca's or Wernicke's, you can have that for sign language as well. So people who are deaf who have sign language, they still have some left representation of language, and so you can see deficits in sign language. But let's stay on track because we still have a few more aphasias to get through. Global aphasia is very simple to remember because everything's abnormal. So language across the board, comprehension, repetition, expression is all abnormal. Why? Because they've had a stroke that involves a little bit more earlier in the artery, so before it bifurcates. So a stroke that essentially would hit both branches would result in a global aphasia. So most of the temporal and inferior frontal lobe would be damaged in a global aphasia. And you would most likely see a hemiplegia or a hemiparesis because you would have some damage to frontal motor regions as well. Yes? The two branches I mentioned of the middle cerebral artery were the superior and the inferior branch. And the inferior supplying some the regions that are important for language comprehension, Wernicke's area, superior supplying Broca's area. Mm-hmm. So this just shows, again, the middle cerebral artery and its branching. And if you have a deficit, if you have a stroke or some sort of embolism here, then you're going to have damage to both branches, which is why you'd get a global aphasia. Okay, now we're going to make a really important distinction. It's going to drive you nuts, but it's simple once you get it. Repetition is going to help you differentiate the primary Broca and Wernicke's aphasia from what we call the transcortical sensory and transcortical motor aphasias. So if repetition is intact, okay, you know you're getting out of your primary parasylvian region, your primary Broca and Wernicke's area. If repetition is intact, because Broca's aphasia, Wernicke's aphasia, conduction aphasia, they can't repeat. Transcortical sensory aphasia, they have problems with comprehension, but they can repeat. So this is damage not necessarily to Wernicke's area, but areas outside or adjacent of Wernicke's area. So it typically involves a stroke in some of these watershed zones between the posterior and middle cerebral artery, because we're talking about a posterior aphasia now. It's a sensory aphasia. And so they're going to have deficits involving more sensory loss, like a hemianopia or hemisensory. They'll probably have problems with reading and writing as well. So this is transcortical sensory aphasia is essentially damage in language regions, but outside of that primary Wernicke's region. So their comprehension is going to be impaired, but not as impaired as Wernicke's. Are they going to be fluent? Is their speech going to be fluent? Yes, because the frontal areas are fine, and they're able to repeat. Are they going to have things like hemiparesis or hemiplegia? No, because motor regions are fine. It's further back. Are they going to have visual deficits? Most likely. Okay, so you're thinking now visual and some impairment in comprehension, but not as bad as Wernicke's. For transcortical motor aphasia, it's kind of it's opposite, basically. It's damage to watershed regions in the frontal and or the anterior and the middle cerebral artery. So now, similar, because the transcortical aphasias, repetition is intact. And here, their comprehension is okay, but they're non-fluent, similar to a Broca's, but not a full-on Broca. So it's not as bad as a Broca's. And their repetition is intact. So this usually involves damage to frontal regions, again, these watershed regions between the anterior and middle cerebral artery. So it can influence speech expression, but not as extreme as Broca's aphasia. So what are you most likely to see with these types of aphasias? Are you most likely to see visual deficits, hemianopias, quadratinopias? No, but motor deficits? Probably. So this is the type of stroke that you'll have some language expression deficit and probably some motor problems as well, but comprehension is intact. Okay, so this is your classification tree. It's going to help you differentiate these. The primary distinction is fluent or non-fluent. If it's non-fluent, it could be Broca's, it could be a global aphasia, it could be a transcortical motor aphasia, but then you have to think, is comprehension poor? Then it's probably a global, because then they have poor comprehension and poor expression in a non-fluent Broca's aphasia, or global aphasia. And if it's good, so essentially comprehension is intact, then it's either going to be a Broca's if repetition is poor, or transcortical motor if repetition is okay. So you can study this graph later, but I hope that the primary distinctions that you're thinking about, is it posterior or anterior? Is repetition intact or not intact? So this should help you in terms of studying or keeping track of these different aphasias. Okay, let's test you. Okay, let's go right to the symptoms that are going to help us make this differential. Okay, so she's older woman. She starts speaking in words that don't make sense to the family. Her spontaneous speech is fluent. So we know we are in posterior areas because fluent speech, all of her motor functions seem to be okay. So we are in more the posterior. So when I say all of her motor functions, I mean her speech articulatory, her speech expression's okay. She can't follow one or two-step commands. We've confirmed there's some sort of comprehension deficit. Her speech is riddled with paraphasic errors. It's abnormal. She cannot repeat. So now we're getting away from transcortical sensory aphasia because she can't repeat. So this is sounding much more like a Wernicke's aphasia because her comprehension's impaired, her speech is abnormal but fluent, and she can't repeat. Yes, very good. Yay. Now, one more thing we're going to talk about is reading deficits, alexia. Alexia is usually the term we use when someone had damage. Dyslexia is when someone is born with reading problems. But alexia is when someone has had some sort of damage to word reading areas, so word blindness and ability to read. We think of it as a disconnection between the visual system for reading and the language system. Now, we know vision is bilateral. So if someone has, let's say, a stroke in their left visual cortex, let's say, near their visual word form area, but they have a right visual cortex and they can essentially see words in the left visual field because they have a right, or so if they have a left lesion, but the right visual cortex is okay, they will be able to read unless there is some sort of damage to the corpus callosum connecting those visual regions to Wernicke's or the left visual word form area. So basically all language has to get to the language areas. So even if the right visual field or right visual cortex is intact in a left occipital lesion, right, if there's damage to the corpus callosum, and this is the famous case that Desjardins studied where the patient had damage to the left visual cortex and the corpus callosum splenium, so that information couldn't get across from the right hemisphere, so he couldn't read. So that was a famous alexia case. And that's what these slides are describing, is this type of case. So just to have it depicted in a picture, so damage to left visual cortices, but here this is intact, so they could probably see words in their left visual field unless they can't get that information to Wernicke's, where they need it to understand it and read it. Okay, so these slides have confused students in the past, but the key here is you need two lesions in the left visual cortex and in the corpus callosum. Now, dyslexia is a learning disability that children are born with. It doesn't come up until later when they start falling behind their peers in terms of reading. But the important point for you to remember is that this involves some sort of abnormalities, and they're probably malformations of cortical development, some abnormalities in either the left inferior ventral stream, so that word form area, or the dorsal stream, which would be more the angular gyrus and Wernicke pathways, visual pathways that are more dorsal. So those are different types of dyslexia. They call it a shallow or a deep dyslexia. But in general, the understanding is that dyslexia is difficulty in processing phonemes and being able to convert phonemes to meaning, to understanding. So we would call it orthographic to phonetic conversion, problems with that, or phonetic awareness is at the heart of most dyslexias. Okay, let's test you with one more question. Okay, here we have a younger woman. She has disordered speech. Her speech is fluent. So what does that immediately tell us? More posterior. Again, if speech is fluent, then she's able to express that we're out of Broca's area, we're out of the transcortical motor aphasia. So now we're kind of making the differential between Wernicke's and transcortical sensory. So we look, can she repeat? She can repeat. Okay, we're thinking transcortical sensory. She has naming impairment. That's all consistent with transcortical sensory, mild auditory naming. So we're thinking, what is an, oh no, here's a lead in, it's tricky. If it was just asking if it's a transcortical sensory, we'd be fine, but it's asking us what additional deficit. So what are we likely to see with a transcortical sensory aphasia? Definitely not hemiplegia or hemiparesis. We can rule those out because it's too far back. Okay, maybe some visual problems. Hemianopia or quadratinopia, but on the left, no, because they'd be on the right. So we can rule out these, although visual problems could be there, right? But they probably, is most likely she has a left damage, so these wouldn't make sense. She'd have a right visual deficit. Dysarthria wouldn't make sense because that's more of a motor. So we're left with alexia. That's a tough one, okay, I admit. But do you understand the logic? All right, good. And for those of you who want to see, yes? The visual pathways. So you'd have, if you have damage on the left, you'd have visual deficits in your right visual field. That's why. So I didn't put right hemianopia or right quadratinopia because that would be really confusing, right? Because she might have those. But an alexia is most likely. Yes? I'm sorry, repeat. Yes. So the main difference between a Broca's aphasia and a transcortical motory is that Broca's can't repeat. They can't do sentence repetition. For those of you who really cared about Sarah and what happened to her, I'm going to show you her 7 years after her stroke, after lots of rehab. But if you want to take a break, go ahead. This is just for those who... Whoops, sorry. Oh, I lied. Oh, no. It's not working. Oh, there we go. Do we have sound? Okay, take-home point is she can talk. She's done really well. And she's improved a lot. So if you want to look her up on YouTube, Sarah Scott, 7 years after her stroke, you can hear how she's improved across the years in rehab. Okay. Sorry.